Welcome back. Up last on our agenda today is the Loch Ness project update. As you may remember, we had a presentation before they went out at sea, so here's just kind of the results. We are going to have a presentation from, and excuse me if I get your names wrong, Ginny Rubin and Dar McCorkle. Is that correct? Oh, sorry, Dan.
Hopefully you can hear us. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate the opportunity to come and speak to this group here today. The council, like you mentioned, we were really appreciative of your feedback about a year ago as we were in the planning process for this work, and are really excited to be here to share some interim results from our field trial, but also some from some of our other research that we've been working on as part of the project. So just a reminder, my name is Jenny Rubin. I'm here with my colleague, Dan McCorkle. Both of us are here from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, here to provide an update on the HUI Loch Ness project. So that's short for Locking Ocean Carbon in the Northeast Shelf and Slope. Okay, hopefully maybe this clicker, whoopsie, clicker works. There we go. All right, so this presentation is sort of oriented in three different sections. I'm just giving a little bit of background about marine carbon dioxide removal, what this project is all about. I know we gave some of this information when we spoke to you all the first time, but just to, as a sort of reminder for anybody who might be new here in the room. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about our laboratory work and our field trial results. So just to give you a little bit of background, our team is quite large and interdisciplinary. This is mostly based at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. You've got photos of our RPI team here on the screen. But we also have colleagues from Rutgers University, Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, Environmental Defense Fund, and UC Santa Barbara, working on all sorts of different aspects of the project. It's an interdisciplinary research program for which is centered around a field trial that occurred this past summer that I'm here to talk about. But we have all sorts of different types of work that's going on under the umbrella of this research program. To give you all a reminder of what marine carbon dioxide removal is and why we're even here researching this, their national and international bodies have identified the need for carbon dioxide removal in addition to emissions reductions in order to meet climate mitigation targets. And what's become clear over the past several years or so in the international and national reports has been identifying the ocean as a potential reservoir, as a place to store that carbon for long periods of time and durably. So on the screen, what you're looking at is the size of the carbon reservoirs for different biomes on the planet. And the ocean is the largest reservoir of carbon on our Earth's surface. And so the idea around marine carbon dioxide removal is, can you move some of the carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere and store it durably in the ocean for long periods of time? The deep ocean stores 15 to 20 times more carbon than land, plants, and soils all together. It stores 40 times more carbon than the atmosphere and 5,000 times more carbon than blue carbon ecosystems like seagrasses, salt marshes, and mangroves. And so this is why the scientific community is turning a bit more towards the open ocean as a potential way to store carbon safely and durably for long periods of time. However, this is still very much in the early phases of research. There are a number of different strategies that have been proposed in order to cause that transfer of carbon from the atmosphere into the ocean. We are here today studying one of those strategies called ocean alkalinity enhancement. Ocean alkalinity enhancement essentially is a process by which you add alkaline materials to our surface oceans that raises the ocean pH and causes an acceleration of the transfer of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere to the ocean, again, by boosting the alkalinity of the surface ocean. It causes a series of chemical reactions that lowers the concentration of carbon dioxide in seawater, promoting carbon dioxide uptake from the atmosphere, and durably stores it in the ocean, essentially as bicarbonate for very long periods of time, and bicarbonate is one of the parts of baking soda. So alkalinity enhancement is not actually a new idea. This strategy has been used in freshwater systems for decades as a remediation tool to help alleviate problems associated with acid rain. For example, on the screen here is a headline from the LA Times from 1987, where highlighting alkalinity enhancement as a treatment for European rivers that had been suffering from acid rain, and also discussing the importance and the restoration of salmon fisheries in response to this restoration tool. On the right in the graphic that you're seeing, or that image, is an image from the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife of a gentleman on a small boat adding lime to a pond as a way to raise the pond pH to, again, alleviate issues associated with acid rain. So alkalinity enhancement in freshwater ecosystems has been used for decades as a remediation tool, but it has not been studied extensively in the ocean as a strategy for removing carbon dioxide and transferring that from the atmosphere into the ocean, hence the need for this kind of research to really investigate the safety and the efficacy of these strategies. To give you a little bit of a sense of what this looks like, there are a number of research institutions who are actively working in this space trying to do research on a whole host of aspects of alkalinity enhancement and marine carbon dioxide removal more broadly. But there's also a private sector space that's been developing over the past 5 years or so. I've got some examples on the screen here of several businesses that are working in either ocean alkalinity enhancement or another similar marine carbon dioxide removal strategy called direct ocean removal. And these companies are they have either field trials that are occurring. In fact, all of them have field trials that are occurring in various parts of the United States or in Canadian waters. And some of them have actually already been contracted for carbon dioxide removal by large companies or have been even issued carbon credits as part of their work. So it's really critical to have the research community, like for our project, move forward with these research projects to make sure that the science stays at the forefront of whatever the industry is doing and how it's developing. So what is the Loch Ness Project? This project is made up of an interdisciplinary team of scientists, engineers, and communicators. We are all committed to rigorous, transparent, and scientific evaluation of ocean alkalinity enhancement, with the goal of answering key questions about the effectiveness and the potential environmental impacts of OAE. Loch Ness, the project is not a company that is selling carbon credits. The project is not participating in the carbon credit market, and we do not see this project as a pathway to deploying alkalinity enhancement at scale, but rather, again, a research project designed to answer key questions about effectiveness and environmental impacts and safety of OAE. So I'm going to jump into, so that's a bit of the background information, why I'm even here today. I'm going to jump into some updates on the status of our project and where we are today. I'm going to start a little with our laboratory and field experiments, in-field biological experiments. So when we came to you all prior to our implementing our field trial, we had been working on laboratory experiments on the phytoplankton community, as well as in-field incubations of the phytoplankton community and how they respond to alkalinity enhancement. We have also completed a series of zooplankton experiments on Calanus finmarchicus, and upcoming work that we have planned for this summer on the impacts of OAE on lobster larvae, as well as tautog larvae for summer 2027. And just again to thank you all, members of the council, for agreeing to participate in an advisory board for an upcoming project where we are working on lobster and tautog. We really appreciate your feedback and your willingness to help us with that effort. So just some quick results here. Just as a note here, we're here today sharing unpublished results. So these are all preliminary data, potentially subject to change as we go through further scientific analysis and peer review. But we wanted to make sure that you all have as much information as possible as soon as we have it, so that we can help spread the word about what we're learning. So the graphics that you're looking at here on the screen are an indicator of phytoplankton health or phytoplankton physiology. You're looking at the results of two experiments where we incubated whole system water with different elevated alkalinity, different levels of alkalinity enhancement. So in green, you're looking at the control. So that's just raw water straight from the Gulf of Maine. And then each of the pink colors is increasing levels of alkalinity enhancement from relatively mild in the sort of lightest pink color all the way to pretty strong alkalinity enhancement at the darkest colors that you're seeing there. And what you can notice in these graphics is there is a difference in the phytoplankton physiology with increasing levels of alkalinity enhancement. And we see that at the lowest levels, lowest doses of alkalinity, there is not a significant impact of alkalinity enhancement on the phytoplankton community or the physiology. But as you increase the level of alkalinity enhancement, we do start to see negative effects on the phytoplankton community. And this is true or differences in the responses. So for the first incubation, we see a decrease in that in this efficiency metric. And on the second experiment, we see sort of a mixed bag of results, but they're definitely different than the control group. And what's important here is that there is an impact on the phytoplankton community, but that impact is scale dependent. So at low levels, we do not see any effect, but as you increase that dose, you do start to see effects. And this is important because it provides information on potential thresholds or how these systems may respond. Entities like the EPA or others, regulatory entities, might be wanting to think about how do you regulate this or provide guardrails and thinking about what are the levels that are safe to implement. The second experiment I wanted to share was our Callinus finmarchicus experiments. So in these experiments, again, this work is now complete. There's a QR code over there to a preprint for this work, but actually was just accepted for publication last week, so there should be a final paper coming out shortly. In these experiments, we exposed Callinus animals to different levels of alkalinity enhancement for periods of time that were reflective of potential conditions that might be experienced in the field associated with the plume of mixing material. So animals were incubated under controlled seawater and then elevated pH or elevated alkalinity for short periods of time before returning them back to controlled seawater in order to mimic what a plume of diluting material might look like. So on the screen, you're looking at results from exposure. You're looking at survival on the y-axis and time post-exposure on the x-axis. On the left, for exposures of 1 minute, 5 minute, and 10 minutes to high pH, pH of 10.5, and then again returning those animals back to the natural seawater that the control group was being was experiencing. And what we found in these experiments was that longer exposures, so at 10 minutes, exposure to pH 10.5, alkalinity enhancement, does impact the survival of these animals. So we saw reduced survival after 72 hours. And we also did another experiment. I don't have those results on the screen here today, but looking at escape performance. So how did those animals respond? Were they able to escape stimulus after exposure? And we also saw there was a reduced escape response in that 10 minute exposure to 10.5 pH. I will note 1 and 5 minute exposures were not significantly different from the control. So again, the potential risk to these marine organisms is going to be dependent on both the time and the duration of the exposure and the intensity of the exposure. And it's critical to think about both of those factors as we are moving towards identifying regulatory guardrails, should alkalinity enhancement or any other marine CDR strategy be deemed to move forward. The other part of this experiment, the same experiment, we repeated this work, but exposing animals to pH 9, so a lower sort of dose of alkalinity. And we found that at exposure to pH 9 for similar intervals, so in this case, 1 minute, 15 minutes, and 30 minutes of exposure had no difference in response to what the control group did. So we do not see any impact of exposure to pH 9 or alkalinity enhancement from these experiments. Again, you can find a preprint of that work at the QR code that's listed on the screen, but it will have a final paper that should be coming out soon that documents this work. Okay, so I'm going to jump into our field trial work here. I suspect that's what many of you are interested in extensively. So the update here for us is that we were able to complete our field trial in August of 2025. So on the screen, what you're looking at is a map of the track line in white from the ship that was actually dispersing the alkalinity. It left from the port of Quincy, went to the Wilkinson Basin, did the dispersal of the alkalinity, and then returned back to Quincy. In the black, what you're looking at is, and the orange, what you're looking at is our monitoring vessel ship track, and I'll get into that detail in a bit more. But in August of 2025, we were able to be successful in completing this field trial. We dispersed about 65,000 liters of 50% weight sodium hydroxide as our source of alkalinity. Again, this alkalinity source was chosen because it is chemically pure. We can get laboratory-grade materials and worry about only the effects and study only the effects of the alkalinity enhancement itself rather than anything else. We also dispersed 1,000 liters of a dye, a red dye tracer called rhodamine water tracer dye, alongside that alkalinity that was dispersed. And this was so we could track that plume or the patch of material that we added, as well as be able to separate any chemical changes from physical changes associated with mixing. This experiment, assuming that everything was purely efficient, has 50 tons of carbon dioxide removal potential associated with the alkalinity enhancement alone.
The pink dot.
Yes. So during the dispersal, the patch size of the dispersal itself was about 0.4 square miles. The large circle that you're seeing in the dashed line there is the estimated area that we had where you could potentially find the ship during the monitoring phase. And you can see that our models that we use to estimate where you might find us were successful in sort of tracking where we thought the patch might go during the field trial. Okay, so this project was permitted as a first-of-its-kind EPA permit for marine carbon dioxide removal through the Marine Protection Research and Sanctuaries Act, or MPRSA. The permitting process was about 2.5 years. It included regulatory, scientific, and public input from a whole host of different sectors. The permit for our project was issued in April of 2025. And we'll have a final report that's due 1 year after the trial completion, so in August of 2026 of this coming year. We've had several interim reports that we've submitted to the EPA since then. If you go to that QR code, that'll give you the EPA's project page for this work, where they'll have any updates that they want to post on the project. So in order to complete this field trial, we had a number of different teams that were associated with the work. This work required deck modification of a supply vessel for the actual dispersal. So we contracted with the offshore supply vessel Mahoney in order to actually complete the dispersal. This required a extensive sort of heroic campaign from our engineering team in order to take that supply vessel and turn it into a dispersal vessel over the course of about 48 hours. What you're looking at on the screen is an image of the back deck of the Mahoney, some CAD drawings that are illustrative of what the deck actually looked like during the field trial. So in order to carry the sodium hydroxide, we needed 4 containers, shipping containers that were sized appropriately, connected to a series of pumps with backups, as well as control valves tubing and large pipes that allowed us to actually have very fine control of the flow rate of the sodium hydroxide and the water tracer dye. We pumped seawater from the side of the ship through large pipes and to the back of the ship to mix in with the sodium hydroxide and the dye in order to create additional mixing and turbulence. This entire ship went from being a blank supply vessel to a dispersal vessel in about 48 hours from our engineering team. This experiment was conducted August 12th through 18th, so the dispersal itself occurred on August 13th. We had 3 ships that were out at sea with us as part of this work. We had the offshore vessel, supply vessel Mahoney, as I mentioned, overall, the entire team had something on the order of about 50 people that were associated with it. The Mahoney had 6 crew, 4 HUI engineers, 3 alkalinity handlers, and four observers on board. That included staff from the EPA, two protected species observers, and a member of the fishing industry to serve as an independent view or assessor of the work. We had, and you can see the offshore supply vessel Mahoney in the background of the image. I'm not sure if this dot works. Yeah, there we go. Back here, carrying the alkalinity during the dispersal. We had the research vessel Connecticut, which is up in the foreground of this image, that had seven crew members on the Connecticut and 10 science team. And then we had the HUI's small coastal research vessel, the Tioga, on the corner of the screen that you see on the right-hand side. That had two crew members, four science, HUI science teams, three members of the media, and two additional observers, one from the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries, the Habitat Division, and the Habitat Office, and from the NOAA Northeast Fisheries Science Center. Additionally, we deployed, prior to the field trial, three gliders. So these are autonomous vehicles that sort of go up and down, and they carry sensors, and they are able to have a very long endurance and be programmed to move about the area. These gliders were out for about 2 weeks before the field trial and stayed out after the field trial about 2 weeks, monitoring the environmental conditions post the trial. We had five glider operators who were on shift 24 hours a day during the field trial, sort of piloting and telling those gliders what to do. We also deployed a long-range AUV for about a week. So that went out the day before the field trial and was out there during the field trial and was recovered the day afterwards. There were three operators of the long-range AUV that were constantly piloting it and giving it new directions based on where the patch was going. So this was a very large effort that incorporated a whole host of people based both at HUI, but as well as elsewhere. So I just want to give you a sense of what this experiment actually looked like. So this is an image from the back deck of the dispersal vessel, looking towards the research vessel in the background, the RV Connecticut. During the dispersal, it was really important for us to do real-time data monitoring of all of the water conditions that we were measuring, in order to be able to make key decisions about flow rates, pumping rates, as well as whether or not the pH conditions were safe and within permitted values. So on the research vessel Connecticut, which you see in the background, we had real-time measurements of the dye concentration, pH, the partial pressure of carbon dioxide, the alkalinity of seawater, FV over FM, which is a phytoplankton photosynthetic efficiency measurement, as well as oxygen concentration. On the offshore supply vessel Mahoney, we had real-time measurements of pumping rate, volume, vessel speed, and we had protected species observers on board who were out watching for any protected species or others that might be present. And what you're looking at here is essentially the dispersal itself. So you can see the red dye and the alkalinity together in the wake of the vessel, of the offshore supply vessel Mahoney. And we implemented this monitoring by essentially transiting the research vessel Connecticut down that sort of red path to maintain and monitor those conditions throughout the dispersal, which took about 6 hours to complete. After the dispersal was completed, the offshore supply vessel Mahoney went back to port, and the research vessel Connecticut maintained on site or following this patch of alkalinity around for about 4 days afterwards, and we implemented the program's monitoring plan. So the general monitoring plan was for us to transit in and out of the patch constantly. So that's what's sort of depicted by that white line that you see there. The idea is that we were measuring the conditions in the patch and outside the patch in consistently over the entire course of the 4 days. That gives us information both on the patch behavior as well as the surrounding seawater and any seawater that was mixing into that patch as it was diluting away. We implemented a whole host of different types of measurements. So I mentioned before those real-time underway measurements, which went on throughout the entire experiment. We had gliders out at sea with us as well as an AUV. We looked at water column profiles, so what the chemistry and chemical and biological conditions were throughout the water column by sampling off of the research vessel Connecticut's CTD rosette. We did net toes, both what's called a bongo toe that gives us information on the zooplankton community throughout the water column, mirroring the monitoring programs that the Northeast Fisheries Science Center runs. We also did Newstun toes, which tells us something about the zooplankton community sitting right at the surface where that patch was located. We also deployed drifting buoys. So those buoys are designed to follow the ocean currents, and they were instrumented and outfitted with sensors that told us information on the pH and the dye concentration, as well as other parameters over time. And then finally, we also used remote sensing assets like our government-based satellites, as well as commercial satellites, to snap photos or imagery of the dye patch and the experiment as the experiment went on. Okay, so I'm going to zoom in here on the ship track during the experiment to give you a little bit of sense of where this patch went and what happened. So there were three phases for the experiment. Our research vessel arrived on station early in the morning, and we did a pre-site survey. So that's shown in black. I know that everybody can't quite see that, but in this region, or maybe if you can see it over here, in this region here, the pre-site survey had a background pH of about 7.95 during that time frame that we were out there. Once the survey was completed, we began the dispersal with the dispersal vessel, and you can see the ship track during the dispersal in orange. It's sort of this squiggle or this spiral that has a bit of a C shape, and that's because of the design of how we did the dispersal, starting in sort of the center and spiraling outwards, as well as the fact that the ocean currents are moving the patch around over time. So you can see that despite the fact that when we were out at sea, it looked like the patch was staying in the same place, we were actually moving and dispersing into a moving patch. Once the dispersal was completed, during the dispersal, our pH stayed within permitted limits. We did exceed a pH of 8.7 at one moment where we were dispersing alkalinity on top of an area that we had already done that before, and we implemented the recommendations from the EPA, or the requirements from the EPA, which was to reduce the pumping rate at that time and maintained those conditions below 8.7 after that. After the dispersal was completed, the patch had a pH of 8.3 at the beginning of the monitoring phase, and by the end of our 4 days at sea, it had returned back to a pH of 7.95. The overall ship track in blue you can see is the monitoring. That's the monitoring phase. The patch, as I mentioned, there's sort of these squiggles going in and out of the patch as we were constantly sampling the background seawater and the patch itself. But the patch moved in a southeasterly direction initially, and then took a turn for the north and towards the west, and ended up largely back where we started after the 4 days were over. So I'm going to get into a little bit of the data that we have here and to show you some of the results from the field trial. So on the top, what you're looking at is what's called a section. And so the y-axis is depth from the surface to 40 meters. And the x-axis is showing you time. The colors are giving you the dye concentration, or the rhodamine water tracer dye. So pink is very high dye concentration, and gray is no dye measured at all. And what you can see is that the rhodamine stays at the surface because the Wilkinson Basin in this time of year is strongly stratified, which means that there are layers of water on top that are warm and have lower density. And it's very difficult for water to entrain at depth because of that stratification. And this is true for the rhodamine water tracer dye. And on the bottom, you see pH as well. For a similar section where the yellow colors are higher pH and the blue colors are lower pH. Again, we expect to see higher pH associated with our experimental patch. Like I said, the rhodamine and the pH is high at the surface because it's trapped at the surface. That was part of the design of the experiment. We don't see any rhodamine or any dye at depth. The pH is a little bit different. There's natural variability in the seawater pH because of natural phytoplankton production. So we see higher pH at 10 to 20 meters, and that's due to natural photosynthesis that's occurring there. But we see the elevated pH early on in that yellow color is due to our experimental intervention. These are showing you a time series of the monitoring phase of the project. So on the left is dye concentration, the one over from the, just I guess going from left to right here, dye concentration, the pH, FCO2 or the fugacity of CO2, and the alkalinity in different measurements. And what you can see is that all of these parameters are, so rhodamine is high, the dye concentration is high, the pH is elevated. Initially, the FCO2 is low, which is what we expect to see, and the alkalinity is high at the early phase of the monitoring period. And then as time goes on, this seawater patch is diluting into surrounding seawater. We see decreases, strong decreases in all of these, in the rhodamine concentration in the pH, and we see the FCO2 rise back towards background conditions, and we see alkalinity decrease as well. So this patch rapidly dissipated into background conditions. It took about 4 days. We ended up leaving after about 4 days because the weather conditions were not conducive to safety at sea at the time. Wouldn't have been safe for deck operations. When we left, we were able to measure very, very, very small signals of this patch, but it had largely returned to background conditions. One of the things that was really important for us was trying to assess whether or not this strategy is effective. So what happens in water? Is there actually carbon dioxide removal that happens? And is it measurable? And from our early results, the answer is yes. Using three different strategies for quantifying the CDR, we can measure and see an estimate of CDR from a carbon dioxide removal in our measurements. So what you're looking at here are three different ways to calculate that carbon dioxide removal using different types of measurements that we've collected. So the underway pH, the underway partial pressure of carbon dioxide, and an estimate of gas exchange, as well as using those remote sensing images that we collected to estimate the chemistry of the seawater and then estimate gas exchange. Our early analysis suggests that in about 4 days, the patch absorbed about 3 tons of carbon dioxide from the air out of a total of 50. This is the equivalent of driving a car about 7,500 miles. And of course, the carbon dioxide uptake should continue happening after we left, as long as this water stays at the surface and is able to interact with the atmosphere. But in order to do that further assessment of CDR, this is when models would take over, high-resolution regional ocean modeling would take over. One thing that's really critical for this is all of these calculations require a tracer. So they all required that rhodamine water tracer dye. That dye tracer allowed us to separate the response of this patch to mixing with surrounding seawater from the response of this patch to carbon dioxide uptake. And so without having that dye tracer, it would have been very difficult to do these kinds of measurements. And it's really a fundamental component of all early field trials in terms of learning, making sure that we're doing these measurements well, we're learning about the efficacy, but will be complicated and more challenging to implement at a larger scale. So just a quick summary of some of the biological data that we collected. So as I mentioned, we did a number of zooplankton tows, both inside the patch and outside the patch, using two different methods, as well as water samples that we collected to assess the phytoplankton community and measurements of phytoplankton photosynthetic health. So on the top panels, actually, I'll just orient you to these graphics. So these graphics are showing you different parameters of the biological community, in patch in blue and out of patch in red. The dots behind each of those larger dots is an individual tow or an individual set of measurements. And then the top panels are indicators of the phytoplankton community. The bottom panels are indicators of the zooplankton community. And we found no biological differences in these measurements inside or outside of the patch. There was no statistical difference between the out-of-patch water and the in-patch water. So the phytoplankton community, for example, we saw the cell counts were not statistically different. We had a metric by staining cells. We could count how many of those cells were dead or dying, which might be a response to the exposure to the alkalinity or the sodium hydroxide. We found there were no differences in the percent of dead or dying cells at the surface after exposure between inside the patch and out of the patch. We saw no differences between the photosynthetic health inside and outside the patch. The bottom panels are showing you those zooplankton metrics. So on the left is the counts of fish larvae per 100 cubic meters of water that's filtered. Again, we see no differences in the total fish larvae. We see no differences in lobster larvae at the surface. And we see no differences in total zooplankton. One thing that's really that's important to note is there's a lot of variability in these measurements. So you can see that those gray dots behind the sort of each of those larger circles, there's a lot of variation and those error bars are big. And so one of the things we're working on now is investigating what's the driver behind that variability, trying to understand sort of how that environmental variability might reflect these data. But overall, when we compare what happened inside the patch to outside the patch, we see no biological differences between those sets of measurements. So that's what I have here to share with you all today. We are, like I mentioned, these results that I'm sharing are all preliminary. So we are actively working on both sample processing still from all of the data that were collected and all the samples that were collected at sea during this field trial, as well as working on analyzing and quality controlling all of the data sets that we collected. So, you know, this is a snapshot in time of our results, but we're happy to continue this discussion and share with you as we learn more, and as we have more results that become available. So I'm happy to take any questions. And again, thank you for the opportunity for, you know, to be here to speak today.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Very impressive work. Understand that you still have some way to go. I will kick off with a question. Long-term next steps. Obviously, you have a lot of processing of data at home. Do you anticipate at some point going back on the water, either replicating what you did or expanding what you did?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think at this point, we're really, our efforts are really focused on analyzing the experimental data that we've collected. But, you know, there are natural next steps to this kind of work in terms of thinking about this work looked at what was happening in water. But there are a lot of interesting research questions that could be had when thinking about larger scale efforts. And so, yes, certainly our group is thinking about this. We're still very much in the early phases of scoping what might happen next and, you know, would love to continue this discussion and be engaged with you all. I don't anticipate us repeating the experiment that we did already, certainly. And any work that might happen in the future is years down the road.
Gotcha. Thank you for that. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for the presentation. That was a lot of information. Two questions. The first one, I was surprised to see that I think you said that the pH in the water started around 7.9 and went up to 8.3 when you treated the water, and it was back down to 7.9 within 4 days. Did I understand that correctly?
Yes, that is
yes.
Correct.
Okay. So, but then one of your slides said the carbon uptake continues. So if the treatment has run its course, are you getting enhanced uptake after 4 days, or is this a 4-day treatment?
Yeah, basically the way I would think about that is after we put in this patch, it's dispersing, so it's gradually diluting out with seawater, and so the elevation of alkalinity is getting less and less through time, right? But as long as there is a little bit, a teensy bit of elevation, then the partial pressure of carbon dioxide is a little bit lower, and then that's what Jenny meant by the uptake presumably continuing even after we're gone. So you get to some point where we're not able to measure it directly because the elevation is small relative to the precision of our measurements. But as that dispersal continues, as long as the chunk of water is still in contact with the atmosphere, we expect it to still be taking up carbon dioxide. But the most rapid uptake was when the alkalinity elevation was highest, so during the beginning.
Okay. Yeah, because I was just wondering if this if you want this to be like a long-term solution for climate change, you have to go back every 4 days and put more of this stuff in the water. I hope that's not the case. And also depending on that water staying on the surface with the way waves and currents and all the rest work in the Gulf of Maine, I don't know. But just curious about that one. The other question I had was whether you if you did a carbon budget for the project. So I think you said you absorb 3 tons of carbon out of a potential of 50, and that could drive a car so many miles or something. I don't know how much carbon emissions come with generating 65,000 liters of sodium hydroxide, and it was an awful big boat that you were out there on. Did you guys think about actually doing a carbon budget for the project?
Yeah, so I'm happy to take that question. The answer is we did not do a carbon budget for the work, and the project is most certainly not carbon negative because of the level of research effort that needed to go into this. So three boats at sea, the production of sodium hydroxide, all of the monitoring, all of the extensive scientific equipment that had to be, you know, used as part of that work. So that wasn't a goal of the project, was to be carbon negative. And so you're absolutely right. For any project that might be an actual CDR solution, you would need it to be carbon negative. So there would need to be less carbon dioxide produced than taken up by whatever the intervention is. And so, again, that wasn't a goal of our work, and so that wasn't part of the effort that we were trying to do. But get to the earlier question as well, you know, those are some of the really critical questions about, is this even a viable solution at scale? Because any kind of intervention needs to be carbon negative.
Excellent. Thanks for that. And I don't know if it's too late, but I think it might be interesting to try to pull out the carbon budget for the vessel that it took to get it out there and what it took to make this. I understand you had three or four other research vessels out there. Maybe take them out and just see how it went, out of curiosity.
Yeah, actually, I mean, so to be clear, that wasn't a goal of our work. We have started working with a group to do that. So looking at what's the fuel consumption for the ship that was out doing the dispersal, what was the production of carbon dioxide associated with the actual production of sodium hydroxide. So we are starting to look at that. But, you know, again, the point of the work was not to be carbon negative, because it would have been largely impossible to do that with the scope of the science effort that went into this. But it's a really great suggestion, and one that we are looking into. And maybe the next time we come and talk to you all, we'll have an answer to that.
Thank you for that. Ms. Ware and then Mr. Pappalardo.
Thanks. Great presentation. Two hopefully quick questions. The first was, it was great to see the Calanus specific study, because I know that's been a big question. I'm curious if the results of that laboratory study impacted your methods, or if you were already planning to be below the pH, both in magnitude and time duration.
Yeah, that's a great question. The plan was always to be below that for both magnitude and duration. So I can go back to that graphic that maybe showed that image. Whoops, there we go. So the monitoring vessel was essentially, the EPA regulations for this project to comply with our permit was that 200 meters behind the dispersal vessel, we had to have a pH of less than 8.7. And so that was always the plan, was to have those low levels at that point. And 200 meters was about 2 minutes behind. So the exposure duration and intensity was less than those Calanus experiments. But one of the goals was to look at, you know, are there thresholds of response? And so that was why the pH 9 was very important as sort of the standard sort of water quality thresholds for fresh water, and then seawater would be 8.5. But also to identify a higher level threshold where exposure might potentially impact a species.
Okay, great. And then my second question was, the roughly 3 tons compared to the potential 50. I'm curious, what are factors that might have influenced only 3 as compared to 50? Like, what are the things that prevented full potential?
Yeah, so that's also a great question, and gets to the complexity of the carbon dioxide exchange process. So one of the things that is a really big challenge associated with the strategy is the alkalinity enhancement is essentially instantaneous. So you can add alkalinity, we see an instant change in pH right away. We see an instant drop in the partial pressure of carbon dioxide right away. But that carbon dioxide exchange process from the atmosphere into the ocean is slow. And so that is why we see a small amount of CO2 exchange in 4 days, roughly, and that the exchange continues over a longer period of time after we can no longer measure it, like Dan mentioned. It's because that atmospheric, that gas exchange, is a slow process. And one of the things that's challenging about that means that you need also to implement high resolution models in order to be able to really assess what the full potential is and whether you've reached it over a longer period of time. And in some cases, that time scale could be out to a year or more. In our experiment, our modeling work, I didn't show some of these results, but our modeling work suggests that most of the equilibration happens within the first year. But other experiments happening at global scales or other modeling work happening at global scales are suggesting that time scale might be much larger. So the difference between the 3 and the 50 is related to that physical process of gas exchange.
And I'll just amplify that we were actually thrilled that we could see that 3. We weren't sure going out there it would be rapid enough to see. So we were pleased with that.
Up next, I have Mr. Pappalardo, then Ms. O'Dell.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming to the council, the fishery council here, and sharing your preliminary information. I had a couple questions. The first is, are you sure you have the right name for your project?
We're sure we don't.
Yeah, okay. We probably don't have the right name for the project, to be honest. A group of scientists did this naming, not communications experts. We have been told that perhaps we should have selected something different by our communications team, but at that point it was a bit late.
That's fine. Thank you. I'd like to, in reading your report and preliminary information that I've had, you mentioned that there are for-profit firms already engaged in this space, and that carbon credits have already been issued for this activity. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? And I'm really curious if those projects that have been permitted on a commercial scale have gone through this type of analysis that you're conducting and bringing forward.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I gave 4 examples of projects. There are others. Those are companies that are already in the water. The carbon credits that have been issued to date are to one company called Planetary Technologies. They're based in their work is based in Halifax in Canada. All but I think one of those companies at this point has not needed, or most of the work has not needed to undergo a different type a bespoke permitting process. A lot of them are working with existing permits at wastewater discharges or other outfalls. So that project in Halifax is using a power plant discharge that has pH limits of 7 at the minimum to 9 at the maximum. And as long as their alkalinity addition does not exceed, their measured conditions don't exceed a pH of 9, they are able to disperse alkalinity into seawater in Halifax Harbor. And so there have been credits. That number that I had on the screen, I think it was about 1,200 tons of carbon crediting. That's actually a bit outdated at this point. They have had several other rounds of carbon credit issuance since that number. I would say that they have not had this extensive level of scientific effort associated with it. That's not to say there isn't research associated with those other projects. So the one in Halifax is working with Dalhousie University to do some of the science behind it. They're not, Dalhousie is not working on the monitoring for that project. So the company is doing their own monitoring efforts and implementing their work through the voluntary carbon market. But those projects they are moving forward to date. And so, again, this is one of the reasons why, us here at HUI, we feel very strongly that this research needs to move forward, because there aren't really bespoke permitting and regulatory oversight over marine carbon dioxide removal activities specifically. And we're hopeful that, some of the data from our project and potentially some of the other research projects that are occurring around the country and also around the world can help to inform any kind of governance and oversight of this kind of work going forward.
Thank you. That's helpful. The permits required to conduct this research was simply an EPA permit?
Yeah, so there was an EPA permit through the Marine Protection Research and Sanctuaries Act, MPRSA. There are another project based on the West Coast led by a company called Ebb Carbon has received a Clean Water Act permit. So the difference in the permitting pathway depends on essentially where you are. So our project was occurring in federal waters offshore, and so that required an MPRSA permit to go through from the EPA. The project on the West Coast was occurring in a coastal bay, and so that was oversight through the Clean Water Act. And so the state of Washington largely ran that permitting process in collaboration with the EPA. There was another project on that same list, or another company on that list, called Vesta. They're doing a bit different of a strategy of alkalinity enhancement that's more akin to beach nourishment. So they're adding a type of sand that is that slowly dissolves and provides alkaline material to the coastal ocean. They received a permit for their work through the Army Corps of Engineers that would be very similar to a beach nourishment project.
That's helpful. One more, if I might, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
I guess if the economics of something like this work out for people interested in geoengineering or marine engineering, whatever we want to call it, I would expect that we would begin to see more and more effort in this place. I'm very concerned that we're going to start seeing more and more projects overlapping without the necessary understanding of the impacts, specifically the cumulative impacts, spatial and temporal. You're much closer to this work in this field than I am, or I think anyone here at this table. How concerned are you that we're within 3 to 5 years of seeing broad commercial scale application of this?
Yeah, so to be honest, I don't think we're very close at all to seeing that. The timeline for any kind of implementation of alkalinity enhancement or marine carbon dioxide removal more broadly at scale, if society decides that this is a strategy to move forward with as part of a climate mitigation portfolio, is several decades likely down the road. I think what you will see in the next 3 to 5 years or a little more is more of these smaller pilot projects moving forward. But realistically, movement at scale is fairly far down the way. This is not similar to offshore wind development. So just to give a bit of a comparison to where the technology is at in this moment in time, offshore wind was essentially a mature technology imported into this region, whereas this is a technology that is really still in the very early R&D phase. And so this is a moment in time for this community, the fishing community, to be involved in all of these discussions and in these projects, because it gives you an opportunity to essentially shape where that governance goes moving forward. There are efforts at the federal level to essentially develop individual sort of research programs through NOAA. There's some legislation that's been introduced to Congress for marine carbon dioxide removal research through NOAA that can help that is designed to help facilitate research moving forward, really a research scale effort. But I think we're quite a ways away from any kind of large-scale commercial activity.
If I may, though, I think it's a very fair question, because for this to be useful, if you will, ultimately it would need to happen at scale if this were something that society decides it wants to do. I think for Jenny and me and our group, we see that as a reason why it's important to start doing field trials, experiments at gradually increasing scales to study it. I think Jenny's right that we're not 3 to 5 years from anything like big deployment, but I think you're right that it's something to be concerned about, because it would have to be big in order to be useful.
Thank you for that. Up next, I have Ms. O'Dell, then Terry Alexander.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the presentation. So my question was basically Megan's first question. I was interested in your presentation in that sweet spot of the 8.3 pH. I assume that was in order to have minimal impacts biologically with the phytoplankton, the zooplankton, and to have the greatest uptake of CO2. So it was based on the trials that have occurred in the lab that were related to the EPA restrictions on trying to stick with nothing. 8.3 was a sweet spot, and if you went higher than that, then you had kind of a mitigation to be able to lower that, correct?
Yeah, so the selection of 8.3 was a couple of things associated with that. So we wanted to create a signal that we could measure and reliably measure with the instrumentation. like Dan mentioned, the greatest carbon dioxide uptake is going to happen when the difference between what's happening in the ocean, what's the carbon dioxide in the ocean and the atmosphere, is the biggest. Okay. And so in order to create that larger signal, you need to elevate the pH higher. But we did not want to elevate the pH so much that we were exceeding any kind of safe thresholds associated with some of the laboratory experiments that have been done. And ultimately, so that decision was also made in terms of the size of the patch that we wanted to make. So the goal was to create essentially a uniform patch that had a pH that was elevated enough so that we could see a signal and be able to track it, hopefully for, you know, several days, up to a week, but not so big that it might lead to extensive environmental impacts.
Okay. And then, so just to respond to that, so the next trial, field trial, will be, again, won't be changing that pH, but maybe expanding the area or expanding, looking at different areas, but not necessarily modifying that pH? Or would you look at potentially increasing the pH just to see if it could?
I think it's too early to say what any next in water activities might be. But I can't imagine exceeding higher, you know, leading to higher pH decisions. I think, decisions in terms of regulations or in terms of from the scientific side of things. You know, again, what our interest is looking at the measurements of these signals. How do you, what are the best tools to be able to actually do that measurement? One of the key things in terms of determining the carbon uptake is something that's sort of colloquially termed measurement reporting and verification that needs to happen in order for any carbon dioxide, you know, any credit or anything like that to be issued. But tracking that carbon is very challenging. And so the idea is to make a signal that's big enough that you can measure it, but not big enough that you lead to an environmental impact in some way.
Mr. Alexander, then Mr. Lucy.
Yeah, thanks for your presentation. So what about animals? I know that you've looked at phytoplankton and that stuff, but what about baby lobsters and fish eggs and all the things that are important to the fishery?
Yeah, that's a great question. So some of the animals that were caught during our field trial in our net tows, our zooplankton tows, were things like fish larvae and lobster larvae. And we didn't see any differences between what happened in the patch and what was outside of the patch. So from the perspective of those animals that are early life stages that are likely to be the most sensitive, we didn't see any differences there. However, understanding the very specific physiological responses is really going to be most importantly done in a laboratory setting where you can more strongly control the environment, the conditions that those animals are exposed to. And so that's why we did those phytoplankton and calanus experiments, and we're now moving on to experiments on lobster and tautog in the lab. I know that's not part of this group's management purview, but we're happy to be able to move forward with experiments on other commercially relevant species, because that is essentially, you know, those are the bread and butter of the fishermen.
And I think it's fair to say that there are other groups doing the
yes,
sort of laboratory type dosing response experiments. So, I mean, we certainly plan to continue that as part of our work going forward, but we certainly aren't the only groups doing those sorts of things, because you could imagine that different species, different life stages, would have different sensitivities, or could. But so far, I think it's fair to say it's not like we have seen things that made us rear back, you know. So far, knock on wood, but things haven't looked bad.
Real quick follow-up.
Quick.
Yeah, so I appreciate that because, that's important. I mean, where this ship was what little bit that's left of our groundfish fishery fishes there all the time. And so that's important for us to know what the actual outcome of that was. It just seems like it's so expensive to do. I mean, I looked at my solar credits that I got last month. I had 1.2 tons. That's what my solar panels saved in carbon or whatever it is. That's what the solar panels on my house. That just seems like such an expense for 3 tons. So
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're absolutely right in thinking about in asking that question. It is an expensive research project for the scope of what was done. But again, the idea here is that we're trying to understand from a scientific point of view what happens when you implement this, because if society decides to move forward with some kind of marine CDR effort at scale, we need answers to these questions. In order to determine, you know, their safety and their efficacy, so that there aren't rogue actors out there doing this, or so there are clear guidance and clear thresholds and boundaries for any other entities that might be doing this kind of work. Absolutely.
Getting at my end of my list here, Mr. Lucy, then Mr. Pierdnock, then Ms. Braun. We'll close it out.
I'll be brief because Mr. Pappalardo and Mr. Alexander asked both my questions, but just following up, on the regulatory issue, the EPA numbers, where were those generated? Did those numbers come from your experiments? Were those the limits on the permit generated from you?
Yeah, those were developed in part in collaboration with us with our modeling work, but also from EPA, larger EPA guidance on water quality. So there's inshore and offshore water, or there's inshore water quality thresholds. There are actually not water quality thresholds for seawater, but there's regulatory sort of there's guidance for which pH of 8.5 is recommended for seawater.
Okay, and then is there an international effort to try and standardize this? Because you know pH is a log scale, so the difference between 8.3 and 9 is pretty significant. So is there UN? I mean, who would make a standardization for the whole planet?
That's a great question and a pretty big one in terms of the policy side of things. But, you know, every country has control of their own EEZ and the activities that occur in their own EEZ. And so each country would be setting whatever the standards are appropriate for our own waters that we control, U.S. meaning, and other countries. That said, the high seas are a bit of a different story in international waters. And the sort of water quality standards are set by the London Convention and the London Protocol. So those are all UN-based larger global policy efforts that have been in place. The London Convention was ratified a number of decades ago, and the London Protocol was a sort of follow-on for that. The U.S. is a party to the London Convention, but we are not a party to the London Protocol. So we are but the EPA is the entity, the regulatory body that essentially serves to ensure that we do abide by those rules. So despite not being a party to the London Protocol, the U.S. does abide by the regulations that have been set there. That being said, there are active discussions essentially as we speak in this moment that have been occurring over the past couple of years since marine carbon dioxide removal research and industry development began. That are actively happening with the parties that are members of the London Convention, London Protocol. So there are international bodies that are actively talking about this space right now because there really hasn't been, because this is so new and so novel, there really isn't, again, bespoke regulatory guidance around these particular types of strategies and interventions. So that policy space and governance space is actively developing right now.
Thank you. Mr. Pierdnock, and then Ms. Braun will close it out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this has been a good discussion. A lot of the questions I have been answered, and I just have a few more. If you go to slide 10, and while you get to that slide, I just wanted to, you know, you pointed out the different species that you're using in the biological experiments.
Okay.
I think it's important. You've noted a lot of them are not, they're not council-related, and that, there you go. They're not council-related fish that are regulated. But I also want to point out you want to look at what fish may be in the upper, middle, or lower water column. You also have finfish. You also have the sharks, the elasmobranchs. They all react differently than the other fish. So food for thought for the future with looking at that and looking at any detrimental impacts. You have to look at where they're hanging out. I was curious. You said there was lobster larvae. I was surprised you found them so high in the water column, which was surprising me. But I don't know much about lobster other than I like to eat them. So just want to point that out. On the next slide, slide 10, what is considered a low dose pH? What is low dose? What is that pH?
Yeah, so again, you know, I think this is probably best given in likely this example or the previous or the ones with that
really
shows
was the previous.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
There we go. Yeah. So control seawater here in this example is, you know, around 7.95 or 8. This is, you know, these experiments were done under real seawater from the Gulf of Maine. So while actually out at sea under the conditions, not during the field trial necessarily, but during other cruises that were out prior to that. And then elevated alkalinity. So plus 500 is probably a pH in the mid eights, I would say, and then 1,000 would be probably above 9. 1,500 is probably around. I don't have those numbers exactly, so I'm giving you my best estimate as I can. You know, plus 1,500 is probably around 9.5 or 9.8, and plus 2,000 is probably above 10 or around 10.
Because so I'm just trying to.
When we said low, our thought was that U500 or the 500 increment of alkalinity above the background was probably as high as we were going to go. We didn't expect our field trial to be in the plus 1,000 or 2,000 range. So when we say low, I would say it's low in the range of conceivable alkalinity additions, and yeah, so that's where that comes from.
Yeah, I'm just trying to see, is that a low 8? pH
yeah, so
eight,
just to give you
nine,
to give you a sense, yeah. Sorry, just really quick, the elevation of the alkalinity in the patch from our field trial was around plus 250.
Well, what is that pH-wise?
It was 8.3.
8.3, okay. Now, when you say there's no significant impact, is that a toxic effect, carcinogenic effect? Is that an endocrine disruptor? Is that an LD50? What is that?
Yeah, so what we're seeing here for low doses of alkalinity, we're seeing no changes in this photosynthetic efficiency, which basically tells you how efficient the photosystem is of these phytoplankton. So is it working as best as possible? So it's not a lethal effect, at least in this particular example. This is the physiological measurement of photosynthesis.
Okay, good.
Mike.
Last one, slide 13.
Mike, we're kind of stretched for time here. They will be joining us at our open happy hour session later, so you're more than welcome to engage them at that point. You're getting a little deep in the weeds here. I will go to Ms. Braun and then close it out. Thank you.
I'll make it quick. This is not my strong point. So looking at slide 20, if we can go there, my concern here is the dye seems to follow the stratification a lot better than the pH changes do. And I'm wondering if under different temperatures, different salinities, different stratifications, could this increase in alkalinity, which then leads to an increase in acidity, impact the bottom? I mean, the ocean acidification is a problem, and I'm thinking of scallops because that's what I tend to think of. Is that something to be concerned of?
That's a great question. In this example, the elevated pH associated with the field trial does stick to the surface. Like I mentioned, there is elevated pH at depth because of natural phytoplankton production. So those phytoplankton that are at depth are taking up carbon dioxide as part of photosynthesis. So they're doing essentially what we did for this experiment, but doing it as via photosynthesis. And so you see that elevated pH between 10 and 20 meters on this graphic because of natural phytoplankton production. But to answer your question about the physics and whether or not this material could reach the bottom, this is the purpose of doing this experiment during the summertime when the system is highly stratified. It means that that material stays at the surface. However, if there was mixing or overturning, you could have that material go to the seafloor. Absolutely. When our coastal ocean is stratified in the summertime, it's going to trap that material at the surface. But in the winter, you do see that mixing occur all the way down to the seafloor. And so, yes, that is very possible. But that being said, if the concern is ocean acidification, this may actually end up having some amelioration of that because you're raising the pH to help offset some of the effects of acidification. That being said, I would be very cautious in thinking about this as an ocean acidification sort of remediation tool. I think there is still a huge amount of open research questions as to whether or not these effects from the perspective of alleviating ocean acidification, whether or not those are fleeting and or whether or not they would have a longer term impact to help with that problem. So that, you know, just to caveat that, you can think about it, it would raise the pH, which might offset the effects of acidification, but I think the jury is very much still out as to whether or not that's true in the longer term.
Can I also just ask one more bit of reassurance that if winds were to break down the stratification to start that deeper mixing, that would have associated with it that much more dilution, so that we were already at the end of 4 days pretty much back down to indistinguishable from baseline, and that was with the signal trapped in the top, 7 to 12 meters. If that stratification broke down so that there was deeper mixing, the dilution would be similarly enhanced.
Well, thank you for that. That was pretty impressive. I'm very interested in how this work moves forward. Obviously, like you said, you have a lot more lab work to do. Thank you for your presentation, both you, Jenny Rubin, and Dan McCorkle. We appreciate your engagement here. We appreciate the council's engagement here. Before I call the adjourn for the day, I just want to remind a couple things. Public comment tomorrow at 4:15. Anyone that is interested, please see Alex. Alex, raise your hand. There you go. We will be reconvening tomorrow at 9 a.m. for the State of the Ecosystems report. Thank you all for today, and we will be joining each other in a short while in the Port of Call Lounge right upstairs. So thank you very much.